Welcome to Hashtag Set Life. All right.
And Joe remembered his Bowie keys.
Yeah, baby.
That was cool. What instrument is that?
That's called a stylophone. Nice. And this is the David Bowie edition. Cool. They're pretty cheap and they're really fun. So I was like, I got to have it. And Brad rolled his eyes at me, like, audibly. So I found a way to incorporate it into the show.
Nice.
His torment and my delight.
So he opens with it every time.
It's catching on.
Eventually he'll find a song.
He's warming up to it.
It's an improv thing for him.
Like you're it. Warming up to it. You know it.
I am warming up to it. Welcome back to Set Life, everybody. We are delighted and pleased to have our guest with us tonight. Rodney Sizemore is joining us tonight. Yeah, man. Thanks for coming in. He is a Detroit Metro director of photography. And we've worked with him for several years now as his climb up to that position. So it's been very interesting. You can open that, Joe.
Just yeah,
open it. Well, you're making me anxious.
I'm Joseph Quick, co-hosting with, as always, Mr. Bradford
Clark.
Yeah,
I guess I should introduce us.
Delighted to have Rodney on with us. Rodney and I actually just wrapped up a project that we spent about a month on over the course of 3 weeks in production. And yeah, that one's...
Yeah, that's
say
that's
some
a
words
cool
about
project.
Tweed.
Yeah.
So I know that you guys can't talk a whole lot about it specifically, but I do think it's a good jumping off point because I did have the pleasure of working a couple days on set with you guys as a swing grip, and I had a lot of fun. It was an interesting cast and crew. But Joe and I mentioned, I think, a little bit previously, possibly when we were talking with you before, but you guys were at Eloise for a good week.
Yeah, we were at the Haunted Mansion. Not Haunted Mansion. It's Haunted
Asylum.
Yeah, Haunted Asylum.
Yeah, so what was your experience like there?
Oh, man. Eloise is awesome. So for those that don't know, it's like a haunted attraction. There's like two floors of just like sets, like
absolute bananas. Bedlam. Yeah, it's craziness. Yeah, this the production value is off the charts.
Details,
these guys, the
tricks.
These guys have built this haunt.
Little mechanical things, like
they know what they're doing. Yeah,
this one particular set that we were shooting on one of the days that I was there, and I'm not going to give too many details away, but I had lit it and been walking through it all day long, and then Joe fires up the power to it, and this thing, just like the whole room starts moving, and I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Of course, you got all the horror sounds, because, you know, they're not there for us, for
right.
film, you know, it was set up for...
And I was able to turn most of those off, but some of them are, like, built into the wall, you can't get to them.
Well, they're all on, like, one circuit, so it's one or none.
Yeah, it was just this giant switchboard where, like,
As far as a shooting location, what was that like? Something that was a little bit more, I mean, it's probably the closest thing we have to like a studio type setup for a location.
True.
Would you agree?
Yeah. Filming there was cool. Like it was that's something we need more of here in Detroit. Like some like sets that are like built like that.
Yeah, where you can get behind the walls, move the walls, set the lights up wherever. Your limitations, your creativity.
Tons of mounting
is able
points on the ceiling.
Move.
All the power was in the ceiling. Yeah, it was just super practical for us to come in and do quick lighting setups for and just run through, you know, a lot of times I was just sticking a BNC inside a mannequin, you know, like sticking practical bulbs and stuff inside them, lighting up what they already had there because it was just so beautiful already. It was so creepy.
Was that your first time inside that building?
Yeah, that was my first time in the Eloise.
So, with it being your first time there and going in, what kind of approach were you able to take as far as like seeing some of these sets for the first time and then trying to picture how you're going to approach that from a shooting perspective?
I think for the most part, we had like a... First, I looked at like each set thinking about like, all right, like what can we get out of this location, because it was there was a lot of sets, like there was a lot, like we filmed at like within like 20 to 30 different
room setups.
They have rooms, they had hallways, they had like boiler room look at these spacecrafts, like there's just so many different crazy things going on, and every time you turned a corner it was a whole nother room.
So you just had to go in, you had to figure out like, all right, kind of what section of the movie what part of the movie this is in. Like, okay, this is the, they're walking through like a freezer. There's a bunch of dead bodies. Okay, let's, I remember at first me and Joe were like, oh, let's make it red. And then we actually looked at the set. We're like, wait, these are these dead bodies.
Yeah,
in the freezer.
So, so we pushed blue instead.
Yeah.
They already had, the practical lights were blue and the red looked great, but then it was contrasting. So that when we pushed what the practical lights were in the space, it just,
opened it up.
Yeah.
And part of my style too is like, I do like kind of like to light, like just like give like each section like of the film like themes and stuff, like give different characters colors, like different sets, like different looks, and then just pretty much taking like the lighting style that we were using throughout the film and just keeping that like consistent. Like I like shadows, I like high contrast.
Yeah, I think too many DPs are afraid of shadows. You watch I mean, first off, shadows are explained, right? Light has to come from somewhere, we're seeing things, right? So it's having some sort of shadow across the face or even across the main talent is sometimes really, like, it holds up at production sometimes, trying to just get that when I'm looking at the frame and I'm like, yeah, but like there's a reason for it, like this other person that they're having dialogue with crossed in front of a light, there should be a shadow there,
right? And if you don't want that shadow there, you have to tell your talent not to step there.
Right.
Like, or at least move past the face, but so that you're now out of the shadow.
I think like there's, like, in film versus like a sitcom. A sitcom is all overhead lit and you, like, it's devoid of shadow. There is no shadow anywhere on a sitcom set.
Yeah.
But it has that very flat look to it. And I feel like a film is something you want to live in. So in order to have life, you got to have elements of life, like the shadows. When you get a script, how do you go in, like, start at the very beginning, going into a job? Is there anything that runs through your mind when you read through the script to try and isolate some of the shots or even your style or how you want to manage what equipment you're going to use throughout the show?
Yeah. So I think when I first look through a script, first thing I look at is, or first thing I try to figure out is, how can I implement my style on it? Like, how can I have this movie have an identity, like maybe similar to previous movies I've done? Like, even if it's a completely different movie, one thing I like to do is try to like implement a style. So just because, you know, it is what I like. Like,
right. Your language.
Yeah. It's like my language. And it's like coming up with like the images I like throughout, like, you know, just my, and what I love, like in film, like it's definitely a ball of like just what I like, you know, like everything I like about a film. And like, that's kind of what I made my style. So I do go through the script and I look at, okay, can I light this how I like to light? Like, can I film this how I like to, you know, film, like composition? Like, can I get into my bag and, you know, in that way, like, can I throw that sauce on it that I, you know.
Do you find yourself after, or at any point, maybe whether it's before reading the script or after reading the script, finding existing properties that you kind of watch for specific inspiration or a new approach at this topic or the subject that the script has?
Oh yeah, no, for sure. I would say depending on if what genre it is, like it'd be based off like my favorite movie in that genre. Like, that's kind of like what I, you know, what I go after. Like, I'd say I'm a filmmaker that, you know, I get inspired by stuff. Like, I think everybody's style, everybody's way of filming, like, believe it or not, it's inspired by something.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, they do. They always say that true artists imitate what they love, you know what I mean? And you do so much that you find a way of making it your own, and that puts your own thumbprint on it.
Right.
You know,
and you know,
I mean?
it's taught in almost every art form. If you start in grade school and you're doing orchestra or symphony, you're playing old music that's been played before, and you've got a conductor at this point, your instructor who plays it in whatever heartbeat style he has, but you're still going off of something that exists. Artists sit in the museum and recreate other art that's right there on the wall, you know, or even, you know, like a new drawing, right? You've got a person right there, but all you're doing is recreating what is already there, and your own style finds its way inside.
Yeah, and they've always, you know, there's that term, the highest form of flattery is mockery, and that's really just imitation, right? Mm-hmm. That's you appreciating and learning from something that inspires you that you can make your own.
Yeah, like I'm not gonna read this, I'm not gonna try to figure out how to draw a circle when it's just like the directions.
Never recreate the wheel. Never recreate the wheel. Yeah. Some years ago, I was training for computer programming, and that's the first chapter in every language, computer language, tells you that right up front, that there's like you need to learn the basics of things. But if other creators, other programmers have created a nest or a bundle or a batch, whatever they were called, that solves a problem for you, you just implement that. There's no sense in going and recreating and
writing that same code yourself.
Right.
You could just like plug and play.
It's there, right. So build upon and move it further. And so right. That's I think, kind of our goal, because, I mean, every story's been told. They say that. Every story's been told. So nothing that you or I or Joe or us as a collaboration would ever create is 100% original.
Right, but our spin on it, our take on it can be.
Exactly, and that's what separates it. Was there a filmmaker or a cinematographer that influenced you more than others? Is there somebody that whose vision kind of drives you, or maybe a number of them?
Oh, yeah. So I think Marcel Reeves, I think I don't know if I pronounced his last name right, because I don't think I've heard anybody say it. But Marcel Reeves, he was the DP on Euphoria.
Okay.
And his cinematography and the way he approached like that show and like his projects before and after that, that's something that did like heavily inspire like my filmmaking. That's kind of one of the first DPs where I like, you know, I went through the film and I studied like, mm-hmm. All right, where's the light on this? Like, where was the camera on this? Like, why did he do that? Where's that light coming from? Like,
right.
there are some styles from him that I for sure like, that I'm, you know, that I was in love with. That I was like, this type of filmmaking I wanna do. Like, mm-hmm. And it's a lot of things that don't make sense, to some people. But like, it's just like.
But if you understand why you're doing it, then
that's the secret. That's the secret.
100%. I'm a big fan of knowing the rules so you can break the rules. You know, I'm a big stickler when I'm ADing on a set watching for the 180 line. I very, very rarely have a scripty around to help me second voice that. But I often get rebuttal from the creators. They're like, oh, well, no, we can do that. We can do that. I'm like, okay, I mean, I'm just letting you know you're doing it. And later on in the edit, if you don't have anything else, you're stuck with it. If you're okay with it in that moment, and there's a reason for it, that is 100% when something like that is acceptable.
Yeah.
As long as you do it in a way that doesn't disorient your audience.
Right. It's funny. I would say too, one thing people say about my style, going back to like the lighting and contrast mm-hmm. and shadows. I had a friend like hit me up a little while back asking if I wanted to do a horror movie. Also, I had there's been a few directors that's been talking to me about horror, a couple audio texts. I'm like, oh man, you should do horror, you should do horror. And I was like, why do you want me to do horror? And she's just like, yeah, you're like, I don't know, your style is just like, it'd be good for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny with Tweed, I got tricked into Tweed. I didn't know it was a horror. I told myself, I'm like, I'm not doing horrors. Like, as a DP, that's not my style.
It's not really a horror, though.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of starts off as one, but it's more of like a sci-fi thriller, and I don't want to, you know, no spoilers.
So I don't watch horror, so I don't know. To me, Tweed was a horror movie. So it's one of the things where it's like, yeah, I don't do horror. I don't study horror.
Yeah.
That's like my thing. And
then you know what? That can be a real win, though. I can't think of an example
here,
off the top of
my first
head.
Recommendation is a horror movie. No, it wasn't horror, though, man. It had elements of it, but I think that's what lent your style is going to lend to like that red herring being more believable.
So
you know what I mean?
That's what I was going to say was I think sometimes applying your style in a way that you wouldn't expect it can sometimes be beneficial for the project as a whole.
Like, yeah.
You know, someone else could have come in a traditional manner, having watched similar inspirations, things that the filmmaker might have been going for and understanding that, whereas you're coming from a whole new perspective. So you're going to be more likely to re-envision something that, you know, maybe horror fans are anticipating and you do it in a different way, and it's like, oh man, and that right there is what ignites the difference between that project and you know, anything else in the genre.
Right. Yeah, and I do feel this one has elements of that, because it was very, very avant-garde, I would say. It mm-hmm. was not, the story wasn't all straightforward, but it is interesting.
So you recently legs. Had a film premiere, Black Olive.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that experience, because that was something of partially your brainchild, right? That was an original.
Yeah, it was. So, Black Olive was, to me, that's like the definition of low budget. Like, it don't get any more low budget than that. Like, no investors, everything's out of your pocket.
Yep.
Trying to get all these pieces together. You got like big aspirations.
Schedule, like, that was all over the place. Yeah. Whenever people were available, whenever people could offer their time mm-hmm. up. Mm-hmm. How big was your cast? I only worked a few days, so I never got to meet everybody.
Yeah, I was only on that a couple of days myself.
I think cast may have been about like 20.
That's a pretty, it's a good size cast.
I think it might have been around there.
Okay. And did you guys shoot that all in Michigan, or were there parts of it that you shot out of state?
Oh, no. So Black Olive was all filmed in Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, we started Black Olive in like 20, I think it was 2020. I think that was when I like started writing the script for it. And then I took that to Jermaine Collins. And then it was we filmed the first time we filmed was we were filming episode one. And we were filming that just over 4 days. Mm-hmm. So we filmed episode one. Funny thing is, we didn't have episode 2, 3, 4, or 5 written. So we ended up looking at the script and we were like, wow, this is great. Let's make the first episode 5, because I feel like we revealed too much. So we wrote it in reverse. We wrote leading up to episode 1, which was supposed to be episode 5. And it was, it was tough, man. Like getting everything together, getting the money, you know, just getting people to like on board on the project to just come like help us. So,
do you think that you learned more going through it that way than other avenues of getting your film made?
Oh, absolutely. If I had the money to do it, I would have just paid everybody to do it. But mm-hmm. because I didn't have the money to produce Black Olive at that time, you know, I had to be the casting director. I had to be set designer. I had to be location scout. I had to be a writer. I had to. Whatever is it? And that's just pre-production. That's just pre-production. So
I don't want to ask a question that seems like too obvious, but if you could elaborate a little bit, if you had money to have made that film, would it have been a completely different film? Or do you think you got the bones of what you were going for and you worked around it with the resources that you had?
To be honest, I think Black Olive was like exactly what we wanted it to be. I think it's exactly kind of what we thought of and what we wanted it to be, you know?
That's good, man, yeah.
Did you write it with the, you know, the
budget constraints in mind?
Yeah, exactly.
No, so we didn't write it with budget constraints in mind.
That's
why filming took place over like a year. Like, man, we spent some money on that. Like, I think budget, I think like out of pocket, so Nate ended up coming in a little late, I think on like episode 3. So Nate was there from the start, but I'm talking mm-hmm. like money wise.
Right.
I think we spent like maybe like 30,000.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's pretty close like, to what a lot of the big hitters around here spend on a whole feature.
Yeah. So I think it was around that.
Okay. So,
and that's just like on location, and it's like locations.
The places that spending comes from, you know, people really don't ever consider it. Even something as simple as, do you have trash bags? Do you have waters? Do you have like the number of things that continue to rob your wallet? You know, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, I got the costumes. We got the talent paid or whatever. And your mind kind of stops there, forgetting that there's all these other little intricacies that force a budget to go upwards. So with that type of budget, which is, you know, that's a modest budget. That's, you know, definitely micro indie. What were some of the practices that you put into play to get exactly what you were looking for out of the film?
To get what we were looking for, like we had to be precise because we didn't have any extra days, you know, to mm-hmm. like it was no time to waste. So I had to, you know, we had to come in there with like a shot list, like knowing exactly like how we gonna shoot it, how we about to light it, like what type of effects we want to get. Mm-hmm. You know, just a whole, you know, just being prepared to do the day. It was no time to waste, you know.
And you guys put that premiere on by yourself? Like, was that, so you had to...
Yeah, that was, we set a premiere up. One thing we wanted to do was, you know, celebrate everybody that was involved. Like, that was our first movie as Blue Clover. I would say that's the first one we filmed as Blue Clover. It's funny because we got a couple films after we did Black Olive that's like already out. Like, it's quite a number of films that our logo, Blue Clover, you know, in the credits mm-hmm. for, that's already came out. But Black Olive just took the longest.
Production works like that sometimes. Yeah. You know, there are things that'll sit on a shelf for a couple of years before it sees the light of day.
Yeah. It was on the shelf, for like a good year. So, year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, because I imagine post-production was probably a whole different avenue for you guys as well.
Yeah, it was tough. Audio wasn't synced. Like, we had slate. We didn't have a slate. Like, we did a lot of stuff wrong.
You realize the things that are important when you approach your own projects like that. I think in my experience with a lot of the people that we work with on our sets, they don't understand the value of some of the things that they overlook. And because once it's out of their hands and they don't have to worry about it anymore, and it goes to the editor, it goes to post-production, or it goes to marketing, or whomever is affected by, you know, a slight, if it doesn't affect you personally, it doesn't change your approach for it next time. But having the experiences that it sounds like you had at least puts it in your mind, you know, even if you are just the DP on set, but I mean solely, like, one, you've got one responsibility, I imagine a lot of the things that you learned improve you in that position alone, you know, helping you recognize what's happening around you, you know, what the sound guy goes through,
set
what,
design and stuff like that. Yeah,
it's being a DP, you get to see everything that everybody goes through, and just it's your job to make it easier on everybody, you know.
Joe, do you have any questions?
Not at the moment.
If you do, feel free. I don't want to monopolize.
No, I chime in when I feel like it. You know me, Mr. No Filter over here.
So, presently, what's the future for Black Olive?
So right now so Black Olive right now is being shopped around by like my sales agent, and
excellent, good approach.
Yeah, she's
So you're looking for a distributor?
Yeah, so we're looking for we already got like a distributor ready just in case there's like a network that's interested. But a lot of times with these networks that like try to buy your film, like, I don't like how long they take to get back to you. So to be honest, like, I think we might just go straight to streaming. So because I'm tired of waiting.
You want to read everything or have your agent, attorney, or whomever look over, because unfortunately there are a lot of predatory distributors out there, mm-hmm. and they can get rights, you know, to a distribution rights to hold onto your property for 5, 10, 15 years and then not do anything with it. And now you're locked. So now this property just sits there and it's theirs. Yeah.
And that's why I need the address, because I'd be able to pull up on them.
Right? No shit.
That's the type of person I am. Like, I got it. Hey,
give me my hard drive.
Yeah, where you stay at? Where you at?
Yeah, it's unfortunate because, you know, so many artists are hungry and desired. And once you, there's no greater anticipation than having a completed product right there in front of you and just wanting it to be forcefully fed to everybody that you know and everyone that you don't know.
Yeah, we've got some friends that have been wronged.
Yeah, and for it to, you just want the best for it. You know, it literally is a part of yourself.
Yeah, it's like, it's a baby. So it's you know, it's like a child.
There's no, there isn't, there are a few worse feelings than, you know, seeing something that you put so much time, effort, energy, love, and sacrifice into to, you know, watch it not bud in any way.
Yeah.
I look forward to being able to see it. So I look forward to seeing what happens on the trail with Black Olive.
Oh yeah. So it's we already got Black Olive number 2 like already
the pen to paper already.
We in pre-production for it.
All right, nice man. That's
excellent.
Good news.
Do I have a returning role?
Yes.
Do I really?
Yeah.
Oh no shit.
Important.
Oh. All right. Well, I definitely got to see that.
I was just a beat cop. There's no way I'm coming back. Maybe.
You just got to shave and you know, it's crazy things you can do with makeup.
Yeah, I think I did have a beard when I was doing that. My hair was long, too. So
it was wintertime. So yeah. It was definitely a beard.
Didn't have the hawk
up. It was definitely a beard time.
Yeah.
So let me see. What are some other questions I want to ask you? Your steps to DP, you know, when we first started working together, you were a camera operator and first AC. How long were you doing those things on set before you felt confident to be like, you know what, I'm gonna step behind the camera?
I would say it's a particular film where. There was a particular film where after that film, I was like, okay, I can make a beautiful fucking image. I want this much creative freedom on all my future projects.
Right.
And that film was To Live and Die and Live.
I thought it might have been.
Yeah. And Brad, you were on that film.
I was gripping.
You were on that film.
Group crew?
So that's a film that directed by Kazem Basir. Every frame in that film was filmed by either me or him, and I would say like after filming, you know, after seeing like the final product of that, I was like, oh yeah, and Kazem, it was in a way
you got a chance to see a screening of it, right?
Yeah, I went to Utah. It was it premiered at Sundance.
That's right.
So yeah, we went to Utah, celebrated it for like the whole week. But just seeing that on the big screen, that was like, oh yeah, like I could do this, you know? And then I, you know, coming home, it was like, okay, I'm you know, and this, you know, this was after like Black Olive.
Yeah,
this
you
was
guys after, had already produced Black Olive.
Yeah, this was after like a few films. And then after that, I filmed.
We filmed that in 2022. Summer 21. It was summer 21. It was the same summer we did Power of Money.
Yeah. I think it was 21.
And and it premiered at Sundance last year. So 23, right?
Yeah.
This year's Sundance. So 23. So it was
at the beginning of this year. Yeah.
2 years. So like I haven't seen too many frames of that movie at all. And I think this.
Oh, it's beautiful.
This is to put a little bit of credit towards you, and I'm gonna build up to a question for you here, but Kasim. He was director as well, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was director DP, and when we lit, he has a style that is very risky because he likes to move around. He lives in all 360 degrees of his world, so lighting that was an incredible challenge because we'd go in and we would see a little bit of the blocking. We'd put our lights up. And then they would start shooting, and this is where I didn't get to see anything because we were then gone. Like the Genie team was not on set. Our gaffer was able to be, you know, a room or two over at Video Village, but most of our locations were hot, they were small, or they were just in too many ways restricting. So once we got our shit in and out, you know, we were done, we were out. You know, there were days when we blacked out that house and we did day for night. At this house for 3 days, we blacked it out, and after that, it was just moving lights within the. So we were in the trailer just waiting on calls.
Yeah, I mean that's how a lot of. The
but what I'm getting into was, it was also very fast paced. It was also like we got a lot done. It was a 2-week, 3-week shoot.
Yeah.
But the frenetic nature of how he was able to capture everything. Had to have been challenging and had to have been outside of your just average normal day. So if after having that experience, you were like, oh yeah, I can do this. That was not a level one shoot. is what I'm saying. You were at like a level seven, level eight.
You got shot in the airport for that one, didn't you?
Yeah, running gun into CW.
Jeez. Yeah, I remember Brad telling me them stories, and
I was not even religious,
and I was crossing my.
that was a splinter crew. There was a lot of splinter crew. Not whole days, but there was a lot of splinter crew on that set because we just had to. We had to minimize ourselves to the bare minimum. We were at this really nice apartment building in Detroit, with just gorgeous upper level. And we got in there. We lit while we were lighting. I think you guys were doing some car shots. You guys were doing streets of Detroit.
We were in the back of the pickup.
Gone a couple of hours. We had plenty of time to run our lights and then just like wait. And we were waiting and waiting and waiting. By the time Splinter Crew comes back, there was a fire truck and an ambulance
pulling up at
this residence. And Cosmo was like, we need to shoot. And we shot this long walk and talk from the back of the complex all the way up. We didn't get in the way. We definitely weren't, but like, we kept on rolling.
We just went past them. We went past them on the road.
Emergencies going on. Bigger. Production value. Shoot.
Cameras rolling. We love that, man. There's like, there's some free like production value in the shot.
Hell yeah.
But man, I could tell you though with the lighting, I love the 360 lighting that that you guys did. Like just having that freedom of being able to swing over, like being able to, and not ever having to worry about a C-stand, like all the lights just being in, you know, in the ceiling on top.
It was a challenge.
Like it gave us so much freedom.
It was definitely a challenge.
Especially with the style of the movie. Like we filmed that, we filmed the entire thing on Ronin.
Yep.
Ronin Armorman. And the character was, it was so much moving. If you watch any of Cosmo's, his last one, Boy, Girl, a Dream, you'll see that he did that movie in like 3-4 takes.
Really?
Yeah. It was like 3-4 shots. There was no cuts.
Yeah, it was all honors. Yeah.
This one, it wasn't the same, the whole movie wasn't supposed to be a wanner, but he still wanted to film it that same way, like, don't cut, you know? Like, let's just keep filming.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that happening. I want to give a quick shout out, I had forgotten his full name, but the gaffer on that was Mark Antoine, we called him Frenchie. And he did, it was marvelous working with him, I learned so much, but it was, you know, coming from the perspective I had, he was put through it. And I ultimately, that's why I want to see it. Cause it's like, what did that stress and what did that suffering that we went through to get, you know, things like he went off, we shot in that, wasn't an abandoned building, the new restaurant. It was like an upstart restaurant. It was like all construction and everything. And he lit it with practical. So he left a couple hours and I forget what location the rest of us were at. But it was just him and his small little ladder, and he ran all of these. He travels with he's an old school guy, so he doesn't have like the apertures and things that. He's got a variety of different types of bulbs and wattages.
Yeah.
And he lit it with string lights that he basically fabricated for himself. And I think the only other light we had going was like a Nova or an LED panel of some kind, just to accentuate for some key light or some fill, because that set the whole mood for that entire scene. And it was brilliant. We had no power there. We were running off of putts.
Wow. Yeah. And you just had a bunch of incandescent bulb strung up in the space.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
And it's fun. I never knew you guys went through that, because we're like in and out of locations. Yeah. Like we'd show up and it's like, all right, camera speed. And we'd get in there, we'd shoot it, and then we'd be out to the next location.
Yeah, that's how it ran so quick. But yeah,
well,
man.
Well-oiled machine, you know.
Dude,
all your cards in place.
We did.
You know what I'm saying?
I was trying to remember what location it was. Someone had asked me, do you remember what location that was where we were at the rooftop? What club was that?
That was, 350 Terrace or something? Or 29 something.
The outdoor roof location.
I don't know any of the clubs.
Some rooftop bar.
Well, yeah, so we were supposed to be there. We were supposed to be there, I think, at like 11 or 12 or something like that. But we were at another club shooting, and it took extra long. And that one we lit, it was an exterior patio.
I think that one was that Trust?
Trust was the one that was across in the co-op, right? That was the full live club. Yeah, that was the full live club that we shot at.
Oh, goodness.
So, so we shot a lot of clubs.
Talk about free production.
So we lit the exterior, this exterior patio of this one bar, and that was awesome. We, I mean, we did accent lights, hidden them in their little chairs. We hit our lights. Because, again, now we're outside, and now it's dark, and Kazem wants to be able to shoot. Like, he should be able to turn and shoot anywhere and not have to stop and relight. Like, we should just be covered. But it took us a very long time. So this, we were, it's an outdoor club on the roof of one of the venues, one of the concert venues. And we didn't show up there till after 2. We were supposed to be there at like 11 or midnight. And we got there. There was no one there for us. We had to wait about 30, 40 minutes to get somebody back there because we completely missed our arrival time. And then we had to load up the freight elevator. It only takes you up so far. Then you had to carry everything up. It was at least a flight of rotating stairs, you know, 6 up, platform 6 up.
Yeah.
And then we lit everything outside. Oh, and we were there till sunrise.
Yeah.
There wasn't a regular elevator you could get on to go to the next.
No, because it went to the rest of the venue. I forget what venue it was because this is a club. So where we shot is a club. That's a rooftop club that they.
I swear it was like 350 Terrace or something.
It could have. I don't know if that was that swanky apartment.
I don't know.
Terrace. I don't remember.
Yeah,
I honestly don't know. You could be right.
There's a lot of them downtown.
Yeah,
you could be right. So. What are you looking forward to like in the future? How are you? I mean, this is the beginning for you, right? So what next steps are you taking, or how do you approach each day on set to, you know, continue going forward, continue growing, to improving your product?
Man, I think just learn it, just taking the approach of just being a student, just like, listening to if anybody ever has anything to say to teach me, if someone comes up to me and they think they can teach me something, I'll let them try. Like, mm-hmm. And I think that's
a good approach.
That's what's gonna keep me improving myself, because if you think you can go to DP and like teach us something, like, hey, let me know, because it must be something they're confident in.
Be important.
it must be important. So like
DP is. Brain is very busy. It's a hurricane up there.
Yeah,
and if
yeah.
you think you can just step in the middle of a hurricane, I'd like to see you try, sir.
Right. So I think just always listening, always listening to your crew, always listening to suggestions, always listening to shot ideas and like everything. Like I would say I'm definitely a DP where I know a lot of DPs would get like very irritated, mad if someone's like, oh, why don't we do this? Why don't we do this? And don't get me wrong, I am. If you're not a student of like filmmaking, if you're just like an extra, like suggesting mm-hmm. a shot, you don't know anything about like filmmaking. All right, but if it's somebody like Joe or Brad or like
yeah,
somebody,
when we work
somebody
together,
in my crew,
yeah.
it's like yo, you know, it'd be a cool
refreshing.
Shot.
Yeah,
you know, it'd be a cool shot. I always listen. I was like, what is
you
it?
Do? And it's always because we were doing, and a lot of times, and Alex was great, but he had this idea, he'd have this idea in his head, and he didn't have. The best articulation
sometimes
of
it's hard for a director to articulate
because he
can't just snap a Polaroid and
he doesn't
it out.
Speak the same language we do either
right
he's trying he did a really good job, but you said it best to him. He said I can tell that you have an image in your head and I need to figure out what that is, so let's just keep talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we figured it out, because sometimes you'll think you got the great shot, and then he's like, okay, but now my shot, and you're like, I thought that was your shot.
Yeah. I had a great shot like set up for the camera already. It was a great shot. Alex comes over, he's like, I don't like it, and I was like, so I moved the camera again. He's like, and I'm like, yeah, Alex. All right, so you got a shot in your head. Let's find that exact shot. I know you do. I know it's in your head. I know you're not going to like it until I get that exact shot you want. I was like, what is it? Just tell me what it is. He's like, yeah, it's just like from the front, like close up on the face. I'm like, okay, bet. And I set the camera. He's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
It looks great. And it's just sometimes just finding.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's just finding, like really as a DP, you're just painting you're just painting the picture that the director laid out for you. Like, mm-hmm. like I just like if they can draw an outline for it, like I'll just like, yeah. you know, I'll make that image just fucking beautiful for
yeah,
him,
make it sing.
Know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. And we did have a lot of that. There was a lot of when he didn't know, even when Alex didn't know what he wanted really, he was like, I just want it in this room. And then like you and I would work with, okay, so here's what we got the light with. Here's what we got, you know, and how can we do this? with this, like the least amount of tweaking what we already have. You know what I mean? Because we were running and gunning through mm-hmm. that mental asylum. It was very guerrilla, go, 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 because we had all that set up and stuff. But at the same time, there wasn't a lot of time for rehearsal blocking and mm-hmm. stuff like that. It was like, okay, you've seen it once. Now we're rolling and four takes in, moving on. And it all looked great. And it, I mean, everybody did a great job, but it was very high pressure. And it didn't feel that way as much because of the creative like co-op that we all had. Mm-hmm. We've all worked together so much, and we got in this stride, you know, and it was really nice.
No, it worked great. I feel like that was an elite team we had. Like it felt good working with everybody that we had on the team. Like you said, it was like a stride. Like it was each set, like it was like kind of the everybody executed. That's all I could say.
Yeah. All the cogs fit in just right. Yeah.
So I have like a slew of more questions I want to ask you, but I don't want to keep you all night. So I think I want to end on this one. I've been tossing back and forth a couple of them, but this last point here about your team kind of touches upon one of the questions I want to ask. And that is, what are your thoughts on film as a team sport?
Oh, I think film's like a ultra just collaborative. I think filmmaking, I say this all the time, I think filmmaking is the highest form of art that exists. I don't think anything is above film and like art, because it's like a collaboration of every single type of artist and art that exists.
Mm-hmm. Like, right, yeah. Writers, poets, painters, sculptors, electricians, mm-hmm. You name
musicians, the yep. actors.
Yep, you name it. And every single aspect of it, there's an artist at the helm of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you say that your approach on set and with the individual departments and every one of the crew from the top to the bottom, do you see that every single one of them has a place on set? Is that something that...
Oh, yeah. One thing about me is I'll never be like a budget squeezer. Like, if you can give me 200 guys like to work on set, like I feel like it'd be 200 times like it is valuable.
Individuals you have focused on individual tasks rather than a spectrum of tasks, mm-hmm. the smoother that train can roll. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think everyone's valuable on set, you know.
So, thank you.
You just gotta recognize, you know, you just gotta recognize your task at hand, execute, and that's it. Like,
that's right. And it's two pieces of advice. One, you want to stay in your lane, 100%. But at the same time, depending on the size of the set you're on, sometimes you gotta veer left or right. And I think even myself as an AD. You know, I'll move lights. There are a lot of things that are not my job. And on a big set, I swear to God, you touch a G&E's equipment and you're not G&E.
You're pulling back a stump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
on a smaller one, I'm thankful.
On these micro-budget sets, sometimes, you know.
Depending on who it is. If I know you know your shit,
you're doing
go ahead.
Two people doing the work of seven and, you know, you get one extra person in there. So just to elaborate a little more on the team effort, the camera is one of the few teams that traditionally, even on a small set, at least gets a small team of some kind, whether it be just an AC or, you know, if you're blessed enough to get a second or even a camera PA. How important is the relationship you have within the camera department? And then I'll let you go for the night.
Yeah. I would say like within my camera department, like the AC I work with, Nathan. You guys know Nathan McDonald. Yeah. Like that's my guy. Like I don't even feel comfortable being on another project if he's like not my AC. Like it just ain't right. It just don't feel right. And I'll tell you why. Like Nathan knows all my rigs, all my equipment. He knows my style. He knows he knows what I'm going for.
When you frame up a shot, he knows what you're going to do without.
Yeah, if I'm asking for sticks, he already has an idea like where to put them. Like it's just like Nate knows how to build the Steadicam, which is like crazy freaking complicated.
Yeah,
like, you know, and that's something I could do.
But you're supposed to be doing something else.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. If I'm like you said, with these smaller budgets, you know, I got a DP and I got a Steadicam. So that's just something I have to deal with until, you know, until we're, you know, in bigger budgets.
Until, exactly.
But no, I think it's important. And then for who I had on my, as my camera operator, you know, for the second leg around, Greg Quiles, like it's, I think it's important, like having a camera operator that you trust.
Yeah.
Like I'll give him an idea, you know, I'll say, I don't want to micromanage my camera operator, but I know he's a fucking beast. Like, and that's why like I trust him to be my camera operator. Like I'll give him, okay, I need a
color by numbers. You give him the idea, the image that you want, and then he fills it in for you with his additional style. So you get what you want with his eye.
Yeah, I'll still like, you know, I need a 75 mil, I need a medium, you know, medium tight shot from that corner. You know, that's as where as that framing goes. Takes camera over here. I don't have to adjust this tripod for. I don't have to frame the shot 100%. You know, it's just like, yo, this is the lens you need. Get it from over there. You know, and it's just like, I think just having that trust, like within camera department, you know, I think that all plays a part with, you know, just the overall like beauty of the film. You know,
right. You can have a great team, but if you don't. Like, if everybody knows their stuff, if you don't know each other and how each other work, then that causes the hiccups. And eventually you can, you know, get over those. But those first couple of days that of getting over those road bumps is in any set. So the more familiar you are, the faster and smoother you get through that rough patch.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing is that, you know, your working relationship with him saves you time because you don't have to actually speak. You've got this nonverbal communication from just instinct and muscle memory and, you know, repetition of working together. I love Nate. Nate's awesome.
Yeah, Nate is great. He's just awesome. Good people,
yeah. I try to work with Nate on every single project that I get. Like, there's anybody come to me, I'm like,
you gotta have Nate.
Yeah, you gotta have Nate.
And you know what?
Nate and Nate are always cutting up in the corner, man.
I respect that a lot. And I think DPs should have that. Just like a director should be able to choose their first AD, I think a DP should be able to choose their first AC as well. Because that's key to what you guys have going on here. Keeps together what's going on around there.
Yeah,
you know, in other camera teams that I've worked with in the past as an AD, you know, I'll get people like, "What are they doing? What are they doing?" Because they see you over there laughing and cutting it up, and I'm like, "Listen, like they're working. Yeah. I can see what they're doing. Yeah. Let them do that because you're gonna come over here and bust their balls, and you know you're gonna be carrying this steady cam for the next 20 minutes or whatever, and it's like, you know." Let them do that. If wrists are turning and things are moving.
Where there's a camera guy, a DP and an AC over there, and they're kind of bickering, and then they come back, and now the whole everything, you know, it affects the energy. So even if somebody's irritated that they're waiting on you, at least they're seeing laughter. So they're, you know, there's happiness when you get back to the circle rather than little stink faces.
Yeah. I'm all about having a good time. I'm not one of them DPs that's gonna like complain and talk shit about production. Like, I'm all about positive energy. Yeah. I believe that if everybody's happy on your set, like, y'all gonna make a good film. Like, I think artistry and, like, art comes from being in, like, a good place. I don't think that being negative, I think that shit kills you. I think being rushed, that shit kills you. Yeah. I think being, like, just being, like, really just, like, kind of, like, told what to do. Like, that shit kills you. Like, you gotta let the artist art. You gotta let your people have, like...
Let the creativeness flow. Yeah,
you gotta have them creative freedom. You gotta like each other. Like, you can't come at it with, like, a negative thing.
Energy matters, right?
And I feel like everything I'm saying right now is facts. Because every time, like, I've ever came to, like, you know, I've had to stop working with some people. Mm-hmm. Some DP, like, another reason, you know, why I became a DP, too. I had to stop working with some people because it's like that, you know, it kills your creativity.
Negative energy begets negative energy. It starts in one place, and it's crazy because happiness will spread too, but happiness doesn't break through the way that negativity does, and it can quickly just start to crumble a house. So well Rodney, thank you very much for joining us. I hope that you would come and join us again, because I do have a slew of more questions that I'd love to ask and pick your brain about. But for the listeners out there, could you let them know how they can find you, or
shameless
plug. Hey, I'd rather y'all just go watch some of my movies.
There you go.
Black Olive, we got Tweed, we got Love Story from the Street, we got Rose Gold, we got what's the one movie? I can't think of them.
Well, but, we got Power Money.
We got Power Money.
To
we got
Live and Die.
Hey, we got Scripts.
To Live and Die and Live and
Die. Oh, that's right. You run Scripts too.
Yeah. We got Scripts.
Yeah, see, so much to talk about.
Man, it's a lot, but y'all can find me at Rodney.S on Instagram. And my, you can go on Blue Clover Studios. You can find me too if you just Google that. So,
all right.
Hey, and, man, big things coming for Mr. Sizemore here.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I'm excited to be riding along, man.
Yeah, me
this
too.
Is, man. This is, I missed being on set with you. So it was nice, even if it was just a couple of days, it was nice being able to share a set with you. So,
yeah, and I know we've worked on several projects together. This is the first time I've gaffed a full feature with you as DP. So that was nice.
Yeah, and it was a pleasure too, man. Like, I really, like, it worked. Like,
it
like,
did, yeah. Like, because we both like to, like, I play with contrast, but I like high definition contrast. So, like, there's plenty of light, but you ain't questioning the shadows.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So they can play with the contrast all they want, but they're not changing my shadows.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Like, if we had that, it's like, and I love my key grip, Quinn. I love him to death, but he's not used to those shadows, right? He's used to more commercial stuff. Yeah. But Rodney and I had to fight his ass to keep our shadows because he kept trying to throw. Can I put a light here? Because you can't see your nose. And I'm like, we don't want to see your nose.
Yeah.
Like, it got heated once or twice, but not in a bad way. Just like, you're starting to annoy me, kid.
Hey, I love Quinn. He was down to jump on and run through warehouses and shit.
Oh, yeah.
He's a soldier, shit, man. Dude. He's a trooper.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Rodney. Yeah, check him out, Blue Clover Studios. And I'm Bradford Clark. You can find me on Instagram at Beeford Clark. And Joseph, how can people bug you?
You can harass me on the gram at chaotic_artisan, or find me on IMDb under Joseph Sheldon Quick. But thank you for coming to #SetLife, and we are out of here. All right.
And a little bit deaf. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.